Hi, I'm Kristen.
And I'm her little brother, William.
We're from the podcast Guide to the Unknown, where we only talk about scary stuff and have a good time doing it.
Come join the scary fun, everyone.
Wherever you get your podcasts, you'll find Guide to the Unknown.
This is the Bloody Disgusting Podcast Network.
Welcome back to Horror Queers. We're talking torture, we're talking martyrs, and we're talking lesbians. And I'm Joe.
And I'm Trace, and we're talking what is probably the only film to leave me like feeling empty inside for a significant amount of time after seeing it.
Oh god, oh dear.
I was really, you kind of already said it, but I know it wasn't the title of the film, but everyone, we're talking Martyrs, the original 2008 Pascal Logier, is that how you say
correct.
It?
Correct.
Oh my god, yay! That
well
is
done.
The only time I will pronounce a French name correctly tonight, so I will be Joe this week. No, I was very depressed, not in a good mood. I was very out of sorts on Thursday. I watched the movie on Wednesday. And I couldn't really figure out why, and I do think a lot of it was because like residual lingering effects from watching this film, and that may be overselling it or hyperbolizing like what it does, but it really had that effect on me, and it's the only film to have ever done that.
Wow, that is some high praise and also mildly terrifying, but I don't disagree with you because I really feel like this is the kind of film that gets into your head and it just lingers. Like, I remember the first time I saw this film, I didn't like it at all because I watched it. I thought, holy fuck, the pacing on this movie is all over the place. It's like a bunch of movies in one.
Whoa.
Why the fuck are people thinking that this is such a good film? And then weeks later, mm-hmm. I would come back to it and just think about like, oh my god, that scene. Oh, that thing. Like it's so heavy. It stays with you.
I was working at a Blockbuster when this hit DVD back in, I think it hit the States in 2009. And I had just heard on Bloody Disgusting, actually, that about how intense it was and how it was one of the most disturbing films ever made. So I rented it. And yeah, it was the first time in my life I'd ever just had such a visceral reaction to a film. And I mean, that'll be a good segue then. So everyone, if you haven't seen this film, or if you have, or you're planning on watching it, extreme trigger warning.
Yes.
It is a torture porn film, and we'll get into this debate a little bit later, but I would argue that it does justify the torture in it, but that will be a contentious opinion for some people, and
yes.
I totally understand that.
Yeah, we're back in the realm of Hostel 2, where I have a feeling we're going to have a bunch of people saying, I don't want to revisit this film, I can't watch it, it's misogynistic, it's all violence against women, it's torture for torture's sake. Ladies and gentlemen, we are going to try to change your mind on that fact.
So you had sent me an article from, because again, we actually did do quite a bit of research for this film, and you sent me an article from Collider, and I think it was Perry Nemiroff, it just said Perry, I wasn't sure if it was her or not, but I'm assuming it was. But her thought point was, I hate this movie, but I don't think it's a bad movie. And I was like, yeah. I understand that.
Yeah, that actually seems completely justifiable. And I feel like that's the kind of debate that I would actually like people to come into some of these more difficult to watch films with. You don't have to like it to appreciate it, and hopefully you can still engage in the dialogue around it regardless.
Well, so did you streamed this, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so I actually do have the unrated DVD, which I think it was Dimension Extreme, although mine doesn't have that label on it, so it was a Weinstein purchase. So
oh my
we just
god.
Can't get
it. Oh my god!
I know. But it came with an introduction by the director, that starts before the film, and he he starts it going like, thank you for watching this film, I don't know if you've made the correct decision, I don't even know if I like this movie. He filmed it, he made it and wrote it when he was under extreme depression, and it shows in this movie, because it's a very bleak, dark, nihilistic film.
Mm-hmm. It's very much like, maybe humanity is not good, and we cause our own suffering, and we are deserving of the pain we bring upon ourselves.
Yes. Oh, and everyone, so this, I did want to point out, so this is our pick for the winner of our listener survey that we did at the end of last year, so you can thank Mr. Brian Conmy for subjecting all of you to this. No, I jest. But thank you. We actually did have this on our to-cover list at some point, but we had never actually scheduled it because we just, neither one of us, like, wanted to pull the trigger on it. So thank you, Brian.
Yes, thank you for making a shit or get off the pot, because I'm not going to lie, I was not looking forward to revisiting this film.
I wasn't either. This is a 5-star film for me, but it's not one that I ever want to rewatch. Although, everyone, this is a member of the New French Extremity Movement, and if you listen to our episode on Calvaire last year, it's in that same ballpark. Although hopefully more of you have seen this than Calvaire, and we see that in those download numbers, because it's one of our least downloaded episodes. But
well, this one's also easier to track down. We appreciate that Calvaire is not an easy film to find, so Murders, thankfully, is easy to find.
But I did go re-listen to that episode, and I do say in that episode that I like to show people Martyrs.
Oh, like,
which it might seem a little bit sadistic, but it's just like there's so much to talk about in this movie, and it's also like for anyone that says, oh, there's not really any extreme horror coming out anymore, like I want to see something that's just really gonna shock me, and it's like, all right, well, do you like subtitles? Okay, let's put on Martyrs. Or I guess in your case, do you like dubbing?
Oh my god, yeah, the film started and it was dubbing and I had to be like, no. Because it opens up with this man giving us newsreel footage of like a documentary style stuff. And I was like, oh, this is funny. I don't remember him speaking in English for this part. But it also had I had captions on, and the captions were completely fucked. Like they were not coinciding with what he was saying at all. And I was like, no, something is wrong here. Something has gone horribly, horribly wrong. Dubbing!
It's so nuts. And also, listeners, we'll save this for the end, and we won't have a big discussion about it, but both of us also did double feature this with the American remake from 2015, which stars Pretty Little Liars, Troy and Belisario, in the Lucy role. So we'll discuss it a little bit, but not in depth, since this obviously isn't a remake episode, but we just thought it might be kind of fun just to kind of make a little compare and contrast.
Yeah. So, I don't know, should we get into it? Do you want to do your fact sheet?
Yeah, we'll do the fact sheet, and then we'll move into the plot.
And just a heads up, we're going to be reverting back to our older structure for this episode, in part because we find that the longer plot description is really good when we're doing funny films or when we're riffing. We've got a lot to say about it. Here, we wanted to make sure that we're giving this film its due diligence. Like, we really want to unpack everything that this film has going on. So it's going to be a shorter plot recap, and then we're going to really dive into the issues afterwards.
Yes, and if you are a listener who did not want to watch this film, I think that'll be really good for us to just go through the plot summary pretty quickly so you get all the major beats, and then you can hear us discuss those things. So I think that'll work out better. But
yeah.
Anyway, okay, so yes, this is Martyrs, and it first screened at Cannes in May 2008. And it was released in theaters in France on September 3rd, 2008. Can you imagine being at Cannes and just seeing this with an audience?
I mean, they've always got a couple of really weird films, but at the same time, like, I mean, I never saw this in the theaters, and I can't imagine what that experience would have been like.
I imagine that when the credits rolled, or I guess when the end title card with the Webster's Dictionary definition of Martyrs pops up, I imagine it was just silence and people sitting there.
What the fuck did we just watch?
I didn't look up any like reports of the screenings, but I imagine this would have been one that had walkouts or one of those like people fainted or threw up in the theater.
Yeah, it played at TIFF, and there was definitely a report of a bunch of people fainting and puking.
Yeah.
But I couldn't actually find the report because it's too long ago that they don't still have those news articles up anymore.
The internet was just so old back then.
It's true. It was more than a decade ago. It barely exists anymore.
Isn't that weird to think 2008 was 12 years ago?
I don't care for it, no.
So and this has a runtime of 99 minutes, which weirdly enough, my DVD said it was 96 minutes, but like it is 99 minutes, so I thought that was weird.
It is, yeah, that's the unrated cut.
Well, but that's the thing though, my DVD is only the unrated cut, and it still said 96 minutes on the box, but I don't know, I don't know. But
you lost 3 minutes in translation.
God, yeah. And this was, we're looking at a budget of 2.8 million euros, which is, at least today, roughly $3.1 million. That may have been different back in 2008, depending on the exchange rate, but it's not important. This did not open in theaters in the States, so I don't have any box office, like, ranking or grosses for you. Well, actually, I'm sorry. But it did go, like I said, in France in September 2008. It made $1.1 million internationally, but that, I mean, that's, like, Belgium, Finland, France, Italy, Turkey, and the UK, and then also right. South Korea.
Okay.
Not us, though, because no one would ever go see this in theaters. But the Weinsteins did buy this for their Dimension Extreme label, which y'all may remember from the mid-2000s. In terms of reception, I changed up my cheat sheet this week. I don't know if you noticed. So I removed the audience. We're not going to discuss audience scores on Rotten Tomatoes, and I'm not going to even bring up Metacritic anymore. I'm just going to do the critics from Rotten Tomatoes, and I'm going to do the Letterboxd score.
Okay.
Yeah, I figure because, I mean, not that people that are in Letterboxd are, like, more... I just feel like they're more into film than, like, the casual... votes that we get on Rotten Tomatoes. So I feel like it might be a better representation of what
audiences think.
Yeah, we'll go with that. So Rotten Tomatoes, we're looking at 59%, which is admittedly higher than I thought it was gonna be, with an average score of 5.96 out of 10, but a Letterboxd score of 7.2 out of 10. So yeah, this is, I mean, people do like, or I'm gonna say like in quotes, I think people appreciate or respect admire what this movie is and does.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I legitimately have heard people who say this is their comfort movie or that this is a favorite film of theirs. I do think those people are fewer and far between, but I do think that there's a really sizable population of people, like horror fans, who know and appreciate nuanced, heavy material. Right. And they look at this and they say, this is not an easy film to watch, but it is a valuable film to watch.
Yeah. Also, I didn't even realize this. I pulled a quote out from Pascal Laugier's introduction, and he actually says, feel very free to hate me. So at least, like, he's aware.
So classically French.
Yes. So this is not his directorial debut. I think it's his second, maybe third film. But written and directed by Pascal Laugier. I have seen... he's most noted for this and The Tall Man, which is his first English language film with Jessica Biel, which I actually really, really, really like.
Never seen it. I've actually never seen any of his other films, so...
Well, okay. So Tall Man is another one where it's like, oh, it becomes a totally different movie about 40 minutes in.
Okay.
And some people don't like that and what it turns into.
I had heard that. I remember when it came out that people were like, this and The Bye-Bye Man are the biggest pieces of shit that horror has produced in the last couple of years.
Okay, The Tall Man is not Bye-Bye Man. Tall Man is actually a 4.5-star film. I really like it. Now, of course, Jessica Biel's in it, and she delivers a wonderful performance.
So there's no bias here, is what you're saying.
I know. But it's also, like, it's not really a horror movie, and I think that's I think that's where people, like, kind of have trouble with it. And then he also did, I think it was last year, maybe 2 years ago, is Incident in a Ghostland or Ghostland. Yeah. It's kind of been shortened. Another movie with very, a lot of drama behind the scenes. And it's also kind of torture porny, misogynistic. I actually liked it. I didn't love it, but I actually thought it was quite good. But also like this, it's like, oh, there's like a big twist. I think that one's on Shudder.
I remember with that one, it got some bad press because the lead actress got injured on the set, and there were complaints about whether or not the set had been, whether it had been made safe for the actors and the actresses.
Yeah, I think glass cut her face and permanently scarred her, and that was the issue. Is like, she's like, I can't like get roles if I have this scar on my face, and I think there was a big issue with that. So, I mean, obviously that's a reason to like go into the movie with caution, but it's also some might say it's transphobic.
Right, that is the other bit.
That'll be a discussion for whenever we cover the episode, which that is in our to-cover list, because I would love to dive into it. But we're not talking about that one, so y'all just go watch that on Shudder or something. Or don't. I don't know. But yeah, that's really it. I'm not going to go through the cast, because I don't know any of these people, unless you think there's anyone that you need to single out.
Nope. I do not recognize most of these people, so...
Sorry. I'll do one. Oh my god. Well, I'm going to say Xavier Dolan. How do you say it?
I say Xavier Dolan.
Okay, cool. So that's him. listeners may know him. He was the opening gay bashing victim in It Chapter 2. playing.
He's also one of Canada's most famous directors.
Yes, absolutely. I've actually never seen one of his films, but I've kept up with them, like when they go to festivals. He was also in Boy Erased, which came out last year. But yeah, he has a very small part in this movie, but he's a baby.
I didn't even recognize him when you texted me and was like, Xavier Dolan. I was like, what? Who are you even talking about? What movie are you watching right now?
You sound so fancy with that French accent. It gets me a little hard.
Oh, well, thank you. Anything I can do to get a rise out of you.
I've never gotten a boner during a recording before, so this is the first.
Let's move on.
During the Martyrs episode. Okay. That's it. Let's go through this plot.
Okay, here we go. After a distraught young girl escapes from a building, the film cuts to a documentary-style camcorder footage from 1971. The girl, Lucy, wasn't raped, but she was abused and is suffering from malnutrition. The footage captures the passing of time, Lucy grows up, and she's befriended by Anna. At this time, it becomes clear that the footage is being shown to Anna by the police, who want her help since Lucy is suffering from amnesia about who she is and who did this to her. It is also clear that Lucy is self-harming, and she is seemingly haunted by both vivid nightmares and a scarred, emaciated demon woman, Isabelle Schaess.
So I will confess that when I first saw this movie, I actually did think that it was a real creature, though, because I didn't know what kind of movie I was about to watch. I didn't know anything about this film. So I thought this was going to be like, oh, it's like a ghost creature movie. That's cool.
Yep.
I confess, I did not call the reveal coming later.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah.
I think this early on, you're not meant to. You actually do think that she is being stalked by some creature. And because we're not given any insight into what's happened before she escapes from the building,
right.
You think, okay, it could be monsters.
Yeah.
It's entirely plausible.
Who knows?
Yeah. So at this point, we cut to 15 years later, and we start in with a well-to-do family, the Belfonds, who have a conventional Sunday morning breakfast until a woman brandishing a shotgun rings the bell and immediately kills everyone.
This, I do want to talk about the sequence a little bit, because
yes. I thought you might.
Well, it's, I was, again, I knew it was coming, I knew it was going to happen, and I was still shocked by how upsetting it is, even knowing, like, what... Like, these, who these people are. And, like, granted, we never really know if the kids knew what the parents were doing. I would wager they did.
Oh, really? Okay. Why do you think that?
I mean, they have a fucking basement. Like, I just feel like that's not something that's, like, easy to hide from your kids.
Yeah, or you've got all these fucking people trafficking through your house all the time. Like, who's that old bitch? What is she doing? Why are they going down there?
I know this will never get made, but I would actually watch, like, a movie, like, a sidequel or something that, like, shows the inner work, like, a Hostel Part 2 thing where it, like, shows the inner workings of the organization.
Yeah, I've actually seen a bunch of people complain, like, how did this cult come to get together? How did they get everything set up? How did they... I'm just like, you don't need to be an asshole about it. But yeah, I mean, the film shrouds these people in so much mystery that it would be interesting to just get a better sense of, like, so how did they connect? Like, how did they decide torturing someone to within an inch of their life is going to get them secrets to the afterlife?
I do think, I saw reviews where people were like, it's really implausible that this is, like, that this organization exists.
Oh, my,
like,
God.
And I'm like,
fuck off.
I was like, that's the thing you're focusing on in this movie? Okay. Like,
God, I can't with people who have criticisms like that. Like, you're either in or you're not, and if you're not, then just fuck off.
Mm-hmm. So this is Lucy shooting all these people because I think we don't really know yet, but I mean, it's pretty, like, she is killing these people because she thinks that they're her torturers, and at the time, we don't know if this is true or not, and the dad gets killed really quickly, the mom turns around and runs away, and she gets shot in the back, and...
It's grody.
Yes, but then with Xavier Dolan, I don't know, Xavier Dolan.
Not bad.
She asks him how old he is, and then asks what his parents did, or maybe vice versa, maybe it's reverse. But then she shoots him at the breakfast table.
But you totally think for a hot minute that maybe she's not going to kill the kids, like maybe she's not that kind of psycho, and then like the camera just holds on her face, and she starts. I think we even see a single tear fall. And then she just blows him away in the gut.
The performances in this movie, specifically from the actors that play Lucy and Anna, is just, they're so good. Like, there's so much eye acting from both of them in this movie.
Well, because it's not a dialogue-intensive film for the most part. Like, it's a lot just on these women and what they're giving facially.
Yeah. And so this sucks, but I love the moment before Dolan gets killed. But the real kicker for me is when she kills the sister. And the sister's hiding under the bed upstairs and making the most noise any person should make when they're trying to hide from a vicious killer. And she shoots her through the bed. And, mm-hmm. oh no, she shoots the bed but doesn't hit her. I'm sorry, I'm thinking of the remake. But she's like crawling out and just crying and crying and crying and gets shot. And it's just like, like the violence in this film, even if we didn't have the torture that comes later, like it's so visceral and realistic and upsetting. Mm-hmm. And like,
yeah.
And again, at this point, we don't know who these people are or what they're doing. So it's just like, oh, she might just be killing. Like, I think maybe, I mean, I don't know. Maybe it was trying to be like, oh, she's just nuts after her experience. And she's just going around 100%.
Killing people. 100%. Yeah, no, because I think in this early section. So really, when I joked that the first time I saw this movie, I thought it was multiple films in one.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people have actually said, yeah, it's basically a film in three parts. And this first part is, you know, it's our little brief introduction to these girls. But really, the first part is a home invasion. Possible is she crazy kind of movie,
because also before this, like all the stuff with her getting out, like the interrogations and whatever, that's all pre-title cards. That's essentially a prologue. And then this is like really when the movie starts. And I was thinking about it too, because when we discussed The Perfection for Patreon, I did compare the narrative of that movie to Martyrs, because it's that also feels like three films in one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But that's also why I like this movie, though. I love that it just changes on you twice.
Yeah, it shifts gears. It's tricky if you're not willing to go along with it. So I think, you know, when we talked about The Perfection, we talked a little bit about how much I really enjoyed that first act and how I almost wish that it had stayed that way for the entire film. And part of that is just that was my preferred subgenre. Like,
yeah.
I like that idea of people being caught in a foreign country, not being able to speak the language, and having this terrible hallucinatory experience. Here, I think it's actually more, it's well-structured. Like, it's not dramatically changing. Like, the film is always the same, but it is shifting gears. But it's doing it in such a way that you still, to a certain extent, have to say, okay, we're opening with this massively bombastic opening sequence, blood, gore, you know, people cutting, all this kind of stuff. And then you have to be willing to go along for the really slow middle part where there's very little action happening. Mm-hmm. And if you can't stay on board with this film, you're going to lose a lot of the emotional resonance that comes with the end.
Yeah. And I think also, because instead of being a secret rape revenge film, it's kind of a secret torture porn film, because it does, the film does save that for the last half of the movie.
Well, okay, so this is where I'm maybe just going to briefly interject with one of our source materials. So I went back to our good friend Alex West from Faculty of Horror, mm-hmm. and she briefly talked about the interesting timeline that this film adopts. So she says what it does is that we're actually seeing the effects of violence in reverse. So the audience experiences what these women have in reverse. The beginning of the film deals with the aftermath of trauma, the midsection deals directly with the trauma, and the final third deals with the initial capture and torture. And I thought that was so interesting. Like, I'd never actually thought of the film in that way, but it's 100% accurate, right? Like, we're actually seeing the reverse of what this all produces.
That actually, I'll just do my one quick quote. I found one. It's by Daniel Totaro from May 2009. It's from an article titled "Martyrs: Evoking France's Cinematic and Historical Past." But what he said was, "Martyrs provides none of the usual payoff or catharsis common to the torture subgenre, like you would see in Hostel or Saw." And that makes sense with what you just said, because the catharsis is in the beginning ish. Mm-hmm. When she kills his family, and then it goes in reverse. That's also why it feels so. I think that's why I felt so empty afterwards, because, it ends with the beginning, basically.
Absolutely. And even though the ending is beautiful, and to a certain extent mm-hmm. we get peace for these characters, that's not... I don't want to say it's not satisfying, because it actually really is, but at the same time...
It's not the norm.
It's heavy, right?
It's not how what we are used to seeing in film. Like, and that's also why I like this, because it's not what I'm used to seeing. In more ways than one.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. So, yeah. So this is Lucy. She's played by Mylène Jean-Panois. And yeah, so she thinks that these Belfon assholes are the people who abducted and tortured her as a kid. So at this point, she's distraught. She's still very paranoid. So she calls Anna, played by Monjonois Alanois.
Who is just eating a sandwich in her car, happy as a clam.
Literally just hanging out, waiting to hear from her friend. And I say friend in quotation marks.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We'll get there.
So while she waits, Lucy is attacked by the same monster from her childhood. So she hides in the closet. She remembers part of her torture as a child. And we'll get these kind of flashbacks throughout the second part of the film. Eventually, she escapes into the yard, and this is where she runs into Anna, who has discovered the bodies inside, and she tends to Lucy's wounds because Lucy has, she's gotten in a bunch of scrapes from this monster.
Yeah, and this is also when we learn, this is why Lucy's doing this, because she thinks of the ones that tortured her as a child, but then it's also where we get the doubt, where it's like, Anna's like, are you sure? Like, mm-hmm. You were supposed to, like, case them out, not just walk in and kill them. And so, of course, probably the next, 15 to 20 minutes is spent with this back and forth of, Anna doubting Lucy and, not sure what's going on, but she loves her so much she wants to help her.
Yes. And really, this is the foundation of these first two-thirds of the film, which is this relationship between the two girls, which began in childhood, has survived all of these years, and... I mean, I see a bunch of people say, oh, it's just that it's, they're really good friends. But this is also the moment where, as they're dragging the bodies into the bathroom, Anna kisses Lucy. And to me, as a queer viewer, yeah, maybe this is just a kiss it's just something that I'm doing to reassure you or something that I can use to express our connectedness. But to me, this is Anna is doing this because she is literally in love with Lucy.
Yes. But Lucy recoils. Lucy does not reciprocate.
Lucy does not reciprocate. No. Yeah. No.
Which I don't... I mean, maybe this is a contentious statement, so I can edit out if it is. But I don't think that Lucy, with the trauma that she has, even if she doesn't kill herself later, would ever be in a position to be ready for any kind of romantic or sexual relationship anytime soon.
I don't think that's controversial. It's really unclear whether or not Lucy got any kind of psychiatric help.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we saw her withdrawing from people. We saw her disconnecting from people in the footage, the camcorder footage from 1971. And I think we're meant to infer that, yeah, she was probably seeing psychiatrists or she was probably speaking to somebody, but we don't actually know that for sure. And the way that she reacts, she is still so inside her own head. She is disconnected from everything except her trauma. So, absolutely. I don't think she would be in a position where she could reciprocate this.
And I'll save it for the discussion. But with Lucy, without Anna's queerness, I actually have a way on how that reads into the ending of the film. That I came up myself, and I felt really proud of this.
Okay. I'm excited. Mm-hmm. Okay. So, that night, Anna discovers that the matriarch, Gabrielle... Patricia Tulasne is still alive.
I thought you were saying Patricia Two Last Names, and I was like, okay, Joe, that's cool.
I couldn't bother to pronounce them, so I just said there are two.
That's fine. I love it.
Lucy is attacked again, resulting in another flashback, and she remembers escaping from Gabrielle and discovering another girl. And it turns out that this is the girl who has been attacking her in a nearby cell.
Literally the ghost of her guilt from leaving this woman.
Yes.
Yeah. Manifesting in this creature.
Mm-hmm. So when she's being attacked, Lucy sees this creature, this woman, who she had to leave behind in order to survive. But of course, what is actually happening is that she is self-harming under the guise of her trauma.
And I saw this movie, 11 years ago for the first time. I just remember, because Anna never sees the creature.
No.
She always sees the aftermath. And so when Lucy's in the hallway, because... She says, I'm sorry, I finally did it, I got them, and, the creature comes up and, touches her, and and you think, oh, it's fine, and then she starts slashing her and, bashing her head against the wall, which that actually was harder for me to watch than the actual slicing.
Oof, yeah.
But Anna comes around the corner and just sees Lucy doing this to herself. And the way that Loger shoots this, specifically with, like, the hands coming up around her head, is really, really cool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. A little bit grudgy, in a way. But,
No, it did, I mean, actually, Ju-on would have come out before this, but yeah, it did remind me of the shower in The Grudge.
Yeah. Okay, so before we get to Lucy's departure, back in the present, Lucy discovers that Gabrielle is still alive, and I'll save that until we talk about the remake, but it's just another example how little effort the remake put in. But
yeah,
so Lucy discovers that Gabrielle is still alive, and she bludgeons her to death with a mallet over Anna's protests, and she then accuses Anna of not believing her, and she proceeds to, like, wreck the joint.
And this might be part of the unrated. Do you know if your streaming one was unrated or was it rated R?
I think I had the rated, or the unrated, sorry.
There is a shot when she first hits her with the mallet. It is like a split second shot of her head with the first blow. And it's just her face, not just her head, her face. And it is, like, I pause it to be like, ooh.
Like, it's rough.
That is rough. And then, of course, yeah, she just, like, mutilates her skull with this mallet.
It goes on for so much longer than I remembered. I thought she whacked her maybe once or twice. She whacks her, like, probably 10 times.
Well, and this is the catharsis that we get, though, because at this point, we don't know.
No, we don't.
Yeah.
I think because at this point we see Anna questioning her, we are also questioning her. And because really we've only seen Lucy barrel in the door and shoot this family of people who seem like just regular people, I think we're really meant to believe, oh my God, this woman is crazy and she has just killed this family for no reason.
I think that's another reason why too this movie, again, it works, but it's also so troubling, is because, so yes, we get the moment of catharsis, but we don't know it until after Lucy is dead.
Yeah.
And so yeah, we don't even get the earned satisfaction of her knowing that it was correct, you know.
I mean, I think she knew it was correct, but right. She doesn't get the benefit of Anna's confirmation, right?
Yeah. It's the way that they, like, I mean, it's clear that Loger was not in the right state of mind when he was doing all this.
Oh boy. I'm glad that he had people who were helping him to pour his own issues into a productive piece of creative art.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, so at this point, Lucy discovers that she is still being haunted. So as you suggested, this creature is still kicking around, and she bangs her head against the wall, she cuts her own wrists, and she ends up committing suicide, essentially.
I did mark a comment in my notes about how this, I mean, okay, so it might be a simplistic viewing of, like, you know, her killing herself. But because it's like, you know, okay, well, she's finally accomplished this. Why does she then just kill herself? Obviously, it's because, like, she doesn't get the piece out of it, you know. But it's also kind of a commentary on how, like, if you're looking forward to something, like remember when you're a kid and you're looking forward to Christmas, and, like, that's what you're looking forward to all December, and, like, you're getting the gifts, and then all of a sudden it's December 26th and Christmas is over and you have nothing to look forward to anymore. It's like that sense of deflation where you're like, oh. I don't know. That's kind of how I read it. Obviously, this is a more extreme version of that, but that's just kind of how I felt, because we're so much of life is looking forward to something, and so once you pass that day, actually, okay, it reminds me of this moment in Deep Blue Sea when Saffron Burrow says, "You wait your whole life for a single moment, and then one day it's tomorrow," and it's like, oh, yep, that's true.
Yeah, I think that combined with the fact that it has not eased her guilt. Like, she doesn't feel any better because she still let that girl die, which is terrible. Like, she did not have a responsibility to save that girl. She only had a responsibility to save herself. But that doesn't make it easier for her to deal with.
Yes.
Yeah. And also watching her slit both of her wrists with those scissors was uncomfortable.
That was harder than the throat slash for me. Like, it focuses on her going up her arm, not quickly, it's quite slow.
It's so fucking slow.
And this is, listeners, by the way, the 45 minute mark, so the movie is effectively halfway over by this point,
which is crazy because at this point one of our two leads is dead. I have no idea where this movie is going now.
It's okay, so I actually did clock this. So the first act is 45 minutes long, the second act is 13 minutes long, and then the third act is the remaining, like, 30, 35 minutes.
it feels, I often feel like this middle section drags a little bit.
I disagree.
But I think it's just because you really, I think it's because I don't know what's happening.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
oh, yeah,
this is
sure.
This is the film resetting itself. And I'm like, wait, what is happening? And it's just like, by the time you get to the third act, you know exactly where this film is fucking going.
Oh, and 100%.
Like, yeah. Okay, so while on the phone with her unsupportive mother, Anna discovers a hidden compartment leading to a basement laboratory, replete with pictures of women being abused on the walls, and a padlocked hatch leading to a sub-basement torture room. There she discovers an emaciated, badly scarred woman, who is not actually named in the credits, but is named by the Mademoiselle as Sarah Dutreuil, and she is played by Emily Mastigien. And this woman has a drilled in head plate and a metal codpiece. And oh my God, it is the stuff of fucking nightmares.
It's, and there is a moment. So whenever Anna finds her, she holds her hand. And it's one of the few, like, I don't want to say peaceful moments in the film because you're still like, what the fuck is going on?
It's tender.
Yes. It's like this moment of human kindness that the film doesn't showcase a lot.
Yeah, and at this point, you really get the sense that, okay, even if you want to disagree with us that Anna had romantic feelings for Lucy, she is so obviously a motherly figure. Mm-hmm. Like, she is so caring and compassionate because she sees this woman, she's not even really horrified, she's just immediately trying to take care of her.
And I did see reviews that were like, when this happens, why doesn't she call the police and leave? Why does she try to, well, do what she's about to do? And I'm just like, what would you, like, what would you do? And when we talk about the American remake, they actually try to address that complaint by doing it, and then it's really wonky and weird with the explanation of what it does. But so
Anna brings this woman upstairs, she bathes her, she removes the pins in her head so that the head plate can be taken off.
This is probably the hardest scene for me to watch.
It really is.
It's reminiscent, I mean, I guess this came after the, so it's the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, the beginning, whenever Leatherface pulls off Matt Bomer's face, and it's... It's when there's goo, like, sticking from the skull to the skin. So when she pulls off this visor, it, like, there's, like mucousy sinew goo, like, just stuck. And it looks so disgusting. It is terrible.
Yeah, and we're alternating between the really slow removal of these pins using a screwdriver, like a flathead screwdriver, to this woman screaming as blood pours through the face mask and through her mouth. And, oh, it's, yeah, if you do not handle torture and gore, this is really tough to watch.
And that's the thing, though. This isn't even torture. This is, I mean, not, it is hurting this woman, clearly, because she's crying out for help as this is happening. Because she can't see what's happening. Like, her eyes are covered by the, by the
terrifying
visor.
Oh, it's so terrifying.
But when she pulls out the first staple, like, there's, like, drips of blood that come out. The effects work in this film is, like,
so
amazing. It's so good. It's, but that's also what makes it so hard to watch.
Yeah. Yeah, because it feels so visceral, and we will get to that in a minute.
Yep.
Okay, so at this point, Anna obviously realizes that Lucy was fucking right the whole time, and she actually goes to Lucy's corpse, and she apologizes for not believing her. And I think that is our moment of catharsis, but you're right, it's too late.
Yeah, it's not the expected moment of catharsis that you would get from a normal film.
Yeah.
Or a conventional film, I guess.
Yeah. The next morning, Sarah attempts to slit her wrists, and she accosts Anna in the process. And before we can even address that, Sarah is suddenly shot in the head as members of the cult arrive to secure the scene. Well, and Sarah and the... Go ahead.
I would say this is the beginning of what I perceive to be the third act.
Mm-hmm.
Like, what? Once Sarah gets her head blown out, like, that's done. 13 minutes of the second act, and then boom, here we have the end of the movie that's stretched out for 35 minutes.
Yeah, you could maybe argue that it's all the way up until Anna is properly locked in the room is still part of the second act, but it's like, that's, you know, six of one, half a dozen of the other.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. So while Sarah and the Belfords' bodies are dumped in the hole in the backyard, Anna is handcuffed and educated by Mademoiselle Catherine Béguin about the process of suffering. So she talks to her about their historical legacy of trying to find martyrs as opposed to victims, because victims are common, martyrs are rare, and of course, they are always women.
And you could argue that this exposition dump, because that's all it is unnecessary, because I don't think they gave this explanation to anyone else they had kidnapped before. So it's like, why give this to her? But I don't care.
I disagree. I think that they do this because they're trying to make sure that the girls understand why they are made to suffer in the hopes that it will help them to transcend.
Well, and this is when she says, I love this woman playing Mademoiselle. I think she's such a creepy, malicious figure.
Oh, she's hugely compelling.
This is when, and we'll talk about this later when we get to the themes, but she says, young women, young girls are more susceptible to martyrdom. So, of course, this is a movie. They only go after girls. And this is where your accusations of misogyny can come in.
Whereas I say, like, hey, let's go back to all of our slasher history with Carol Clover talking about final girls and why we always have to use final girls as the source of suffering so that they can grab the phallus and overcome and all this kind of stuff. Like, we want to play fast and loose with this. Like, we love final girls, but apparently when we present it in this other way, which is more realistic and damaging, all of a sudden then it becomes misogynistic.
Well, I just viewed it more as, like, even just the statement is like, it's young women, is like, oh, like, they're closer to God in a way. Like, women are more holy than men. That's how I viewed it.
Yeah. I'm sure we'll have more to say in a minute.
Yeah, for sure.
So Anna is then locked up downstairs, and time passes. This is the part where I think if you are not on board with this film,
You're done.
This is excruciating.
So this is the 68-minute mark, and it goes on for about 15 minutes.
Yeah, so we watch as Anna is fed gruel, she is beaten, and her head is shaved. And over time, Anna just becomes increasingly less responsive. She's never really... She only ever tries to fight back once. It doesn't go well.
But they expect... They make her. Like, because he, like, waits by the door and, like, waits for her to make a run for it. And then also, like, he does something to, like, instigate her to, like, hit him back, and that just makes it worse for her.
Yeah. As we discussed during the Hostel 2 episode, really, if you think about it, this is torture for the purposes of breaking someone down. It's a power dynamic. They are trying to break her, in a sense.
Right.
Yeah. So at a certain point, she becomes less afraid, and she has reached the second last stage. So there's only one stage left. This woman who has been feeding her caresses her.
I guess we didn't really say exactly what they were doing, but they're trying to basically make them see the afterlife, like torturing them into a point of submission to where they are so close to death that they actually do see something in the afterlife.
Yes, but they can still report back because they're not quite dead.
Right. So this cult just wants to know what's afterlife.
Mm-hmm. It's so white privilege-y, I can't even with it. Like, we've got nothing better to do except torture girls to find out what awaits us in the afterlife. Like, get a hobby!
I found a lot of readings about white privilege, because also we didn't mention that Lucy actually is a person of color. She's played by Asian descent of some sort actress.
Yeah, her mom was Chinese, and actually the actress who plays Anna is of Moroccan descent.
Oh, well, there you go. But yeah, there's also a lot of readings in this film about elitism and, like, you know, the 1% and, like, using the poor as products and things like that.
Oh, yes. And that ties into Pascal Loger's Catholicism as well.
Yeah.
Okay, so Anna is caressed by this woman. She's informed that there's only one stage left. She's then brought into another room, locked into a machine, hung upside down, and flayed.
This is actually, too, the one scene in the remake that is more gory than the original.
Correct.
Because you don't actually see the flaying happen in the original. You just see the aftermath, which is horrific.
Yeah. So in this version, we focus entirely on Anna's face as she writhes in pain. And then we see the aftermath where basically all that is left of her skin is the skin on her face. So the entirety of her body is now Hellraiser Frank, completely skinless.
Minus the face, which I thought was an interesting touch to leave the face, but...
It's because it keeps her human.
Got it. There you go.
So, yeah, so then she is left, and this is the only point in this final section, like, this is where the transition kind of occurs. Up until this point, we haven't been entirely in Anna's headspace. So the camera has been focused on her face. It's been cutting off her attackers in terms of, like, the way the camera is framed or the actors are positioned. And at this point, we actually cut upstairs to just see this woman making a fucking smoothie. And this other guy comes in and they look so normal and just so casual. And the guy's just like, hey, I think she's totally ready. And she's completely transformed.
So I thought she was actually making the slop.
She is making the slop. But she's making it using a blender. Like, it looks like a Sunday morning smoothie.
No, it's like a day-by-day slice of life of just a regular white American or white French household. American.
So we cut back to Anna. The camera pushes in on her vacant eye, and we get this slightly longer than I remembered look at this cosmic afterlife, which is lights and imagery. And at this point, we also get to hear Lucy whispering stuff about how she can let go and she can accept it.
Oh, well, that's the thing, though. So, like, with all because we did skip over this bit. So, yeah, Lucy, you know, her ghost, like, what's left over from her trauma is, like, the ghost of this woman that she left behind. With the woman with the visor, her ghost is that she keeps seeing cockroaches crawl over her body. Yes. Anna's ghost is Lucy. And rather than an agent of pain, she actually pushes her towards martyrdom.
Right. And this is why Anna is able to, quote-unquote, survive.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. So this is the end. Mademoiselle arrives. She asks if Anna has seen the other world. She bends down and Anna whispers something to her. And in case you were wondering, even if you have the subtitles on, no, you will not get any dialogue here. So a large group of individuals arrives at the house to listen to Anna's story. We are told that she is the fourth person to reach this stage, but only the first to describe it. And Mademoiselle's second-in-command, Etienne, Jean-Marie Mancelat, inquires of Mademoiselle if she is ready to address the crowd. And she's on the other side of the bathroom wall, and she just says, keep doubting. And then she shoots herself in the head. And at this point, we get the definition, as you indicated earlier, we get the definition of murder, according to the Merriam-Webster Dictionary. And there is a slow final push in on Anna's still alive flayed body before the credits play over camcorder footage of Anna and Lucy as girls.
I actually don't know if it's a Merriam-Webster Dictionary definition, but yeah, it just says that martyr also is witness, which... I didn't do a lot of research on that specific thing, but I Googled it, and, like, martyr wasn't pulling up witness for any definition, but it was going from the Greek definition of, like, where martyr comes from or something.
I can see it in a particularly religious connotation as well, because if you think of somebody like Joan of Arc as a martyr,
right,
where she was getting visions from God and she ultimately gets burned at the stake for it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she's very much a witness to things. You know, we talked about this a little bit with Cassandra from our Scream 2 episode as well, where Cassandra had visions of the future, but no one would believe her. But she was a witness to things to come. And her penance was that no one would ever take her seriously.
Yeah.
So that is murders.
Yeah. It's...
Who wants to take a bath?
I know. I've literally never had a film affect me like this one has. I mean, maybe if we ever watch Solo or whatever, like, I'll feel the same way. But I haven't seen Solo, which is a Criterion film.
It's true. Yeah. It's on the list.
So, okay. I mean, the themes that I pulled just the overall concept of the film is torture porn. The meaning of martyrs with the witness stuff. My queer reading, and there's elitism, and the ending explained, which I thought was a really cool thing, too.
Right. Okay. Shall we take it from the top?
I guess torture porn.
Okay.
So, I will reference an AV Club article that I found on the film, written by Scott Tobias.
Okay.
The explicitness of Anna's torture and martyrdom, a demonstration of female strength and resilience that's meant as a suspect type of feminism, has more in common with real institutional forms of torture and human experimentation, and is conducted with an emotional distance that's infinitely more disturbing and terrible. On some level, Martyrs feels like a comment on other films of its kind, because it shuts down any notion that pleasure could be derived from watching it. It feels like the death of extreme horror, or at least takes the subgenre as far as it can conceivably go. And that goes back to our Hostel episode, really, is like, you know, what is torture porn? Because it implies that someone is getting off by watching this. And this movie is like, no, that's not what's happening here.
Well, there's also nothing sexualized about this torture, right? Like, it's really important. I really wanted to emphasize the fact that they are not sexually assaulting these girls.
Not that that makes it any better, but it doesn't make it worse.
No, but it's, you know, it's not the kind of thing where, like, when you watch Hostel, you can tell that the reason that people are participating in that club is because they are trying to fulfill some kind of need in their life, and they feel like the only way they can get it is by exerting this power over other people. But there is, like, a sexual fetishization that's happening there. Here, that's not what this is about. This is a religious order, right? Like, they are literally trying to see the afterlife with these girls. And the torture is just the method by which they're going to get there. Now, that doesn't make it easier to watch.
No. And
I do think it's important, though, also to acknowledge the fact that Pascal Logier has said he made this film as conversation to Hostel. So this film comes out in the wake of Hostel and Hostel Part 2.
Yeah, no, it comes out, it is screened at Cannes almost a full year after Hostel 2 came out.
Okay, so this is his take on the idea of torture porn, but he has explicitly said that he didn't want to deal with the torture, he wanted to deal with the suffering.
And I think that the 15-minute torture sequence, obviously that's the biggest issue people have with the film, where they're like, why? Why can't you skip over that and just tell us? Why do you have to show us that? I would argue that you do have to show us this, because not only is the film beating Anna into submission, but it's also beating
us into submission.
Absolutely. Yeah. And whereas I can see how someone would, I mean, again, like, we talked about Heather Matarazzo's death in Hostel 2, which I do think is very disturbing, but there's also something, like, beautiful about it, like the way it's shot and framed. Nothing about this is beautiful. This is all horrific, gross, and ugly. And that I actually think that is a more effective way of dealing with this. And it's just a torture film. I would never call this torture porn.
I do have a quote from Pascal Logier from, so this is a quote that's captured in the chapter on martyrs in Alex West's book, The New French Extremity. And he says, "I really wanted to give answers to the audience for the amount of violence I was putting them through. I am not the kind of guy who can show very brutal sequences without a reason behind it. It wasn't a matter of self-justification, because I hate that. It was more a way of helping to relieve the audience, to give the audience a reason to stay in the theater. Believe it or not, I didn't make the film to shock or create any sort of scandal. I wrote the film in a very sincere state of mind. I was feeling pain, and I wanted the audience to share that pain as part of a very honest process. I wasn't aware at the time that I wrote it that I was crossing any lines. I was thinking I'm going to make the audience feel the real pain."
And I would argue that he does. And I'm not saying that you should want that, and that you, like, it's a good thing to feel. But if you're going to watch a horror movie or something like this, it accomplishes what it sets out to do. And I do think that viewing it as, like, exploitative is doing this a disservice.
Okay, so I've got some other stuff that I think could maybe help to contextualize this, because I don't want to diminish people's discomfort or their struggle if they try to watch this and they're just like, you know what, I can't. So part of this is that what I want to try to encourage people to do is dissociate the discomfort from something like, oh, this is a claim of misogyny, because I think that those are two very, very different kinds of arguments. So I'm going to reference the introduction from a book called The New Extremism in Cinema by Tanya Horick and Tina Kendall. And this is a really interesting book because it addresses this rise in extremism in film, and it starts in France, and then it actually documents a transition across European cinema. So they're not actually looking specifically just at films of the new extreme, but they're looking at it as like part of a larger movement. And one of the things that they're really interested in is how much emotion and like a physical reaction to watching these films is part of the intended process. So these films situate sex and violence as a means of interrogating the relationship between films and their spectators in the late 20th and early 21st centuries. In their concerted practice of provocation as a mode of address, these films of the new extremism bring the notion of response to the fore, interrogating, challenging, and often destroying the notion of a passive or disinterested spectator. So right off the bat, what Horick and Kendall are saying here is that these films are deliberately trying to get a rise out of you. So Pascal Loge said that he didn't do this to upset people, mm-hmm. but he is trying to get people to feel something. So if we take that the next step further, many of them tend to represent subjects, rape, necrophilia, self-mutilation, bashing, slashings, blindings, hard-ons, cannibalism, sadomasochism, incest, through techniques that heighten the sensory and affective involvement of audiences, foregrounding the question of spectatorial response in a way that unites the intellectual and the visceral. So, in a sense, they're a form of embodied dialogue that takes place between film, spectator, and context. So what they're really trying to get you to do is the films want you to have this dialogue about your position as a spectator while you're watching these films. So you can't be passive. You can't just watch Martyrs and be like, that was a movie I watched. It's like, you have to feel it. Like, you have to be grossed out. You have to be upset. You have to be even disinterested or angry, right? So they call for a sustained consideration of the complex relations between aesthetics and politics as they're constructed through dialogue between the film and the spectator. And then they're reproduced and reconfigured through the vociferous public debates that these films tend to leave in their wake. So the power of the film becomes not just in the filmmaking process or the watching and the reacting, but also then the debate that we have about the film, mm-hmm. and that's where the power lies.
Well, yeah, this is a film that you want to discuss afterwards, and it's no matter how you feel about it, it is a film that will stick with you. I mean, you will feel something.
Oh yeah,
after watching this film. And granted, I've seen a wide range. I saw a review that referred to it as boring, specifically in the torture section, saying this isn't entertaining or involving, it's just boring. And I was like,
I mean, guess what, I don't think the movie is trying to be entertaining in
No. I mean, I get that, but I was like boring is an interesting word to use for some of this movie.
I could even see like monotony, because really it's like you're really just living with the torture with mm-hmm. Anna day in and day out for all of these days. Like, we don't even know how much time is passing.
No,
and it does become repetitive, and it does become terrifying in just its abjectness, right? But that's the purpose.
I did a bullet list of just what she goes through, and I was like, okay, cool. Slop, she spits it up and gets a slap. Then she pees in her bucket through the chair hole, because she has a chair hole. A man unchains her and beats the fuck out of her. Then she gets a haircut. Then there's more beatings. Then there's a sponge bath. Then there's more beatings. Then she sees Lucy and accepts her life. Then there's slop. Then there's more beatings. Like, it's yeah. like, it's that's what we're going through, and, you know, it's not good. Like, you're not going to feel good watching this, but...
No. It's meant to be hard.
Yes, and Loge, if he just wants to inspire a feeling, that is done with all of this.
Yeah, and that I think is why you end this film feeling a little bit dead inside, and a little mm-hmm. bit like, wow, I'm just exhausted by this process. But think about it, like, you introduced this episode by saying that no film has ever made you feel the way that you did when you first saw it.
Mm-hmm.
And that is powerful.
It is.
You know, it's not good per se, but you can't say that this film doesn't leave an impact.
Well, and that's why, though, to me, this is a 5 out of 5 film. It's not one that I want to rewatch often or ever, really. But and that's why when I quoted Perry again, I think Nemi Roth, but whoops, saying like, I hate this film, but I don't think it's a bad one. And I think it's like, I hate that this film makes me feel this way. And that, again, that is the power of cinema, and one of the only instances to like make me feel this. And it's just that it does that. I was like, that, I mean, it's art. it is art, and it's powerful. And that something is, has that much of an effect on me, I was like, that deserves 5 stars for me, no matter what, even if I don't really enjoy the experience.
Yeah.
So.
Next topic.
Maybe we'll do the elitism and kind of stuff. And this can be a shorter conversation, just because I think it's important to touch on.
Yep.
So this is from an article called Keep Doubting Why Martyrs is One of Horror's Most Biting Critiques on Systems of Violence and Oppression.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, when Anna's getting tortured, it's Angie is the author. There's no other credit. Angie writes, "This process of torture becomes a way that Anna can prove her usefulness to the elite. And in this way, via treating her body as a product or a commodity, Anna's torture is akin to slavery. Her body and personhood isn't of use until the elite can profit from its production. And in her final moments, Anna's ultimate sacrifice and assimilation comes from not only the removal of the physical traits that mark her as other or brown or minority, but from her body providing a good to her abusers. She literally becomes a product." And so she posits that the film points a mirror at the viewer, which is also what makes the film so uncomfortable to watch. She says... "We like to point fingers and accuse the 1% of terrible deeds, but what makes us better than the elite? In reality, nothing. Our moral compass is no better. We buy fast fashion shirts and tops so cheap that we can only surmise that they are produced in overseas sweatshops. We purchase chocolate from companies that publicly face accusations of engaging in modern-day slavery. We hear stories of young girls being sold into sex trafficking and continue to vacation and spend our dollars in areas known for such atrocities. And just as in the film, many of these horrors disproportionately impact women of color. In Martyrs, Logier forces us to engage with suffering in a very direct and personal manner. We become martyrs of a different sort, the ones who see and bear witness yet do nothing."
Yeah.
I think that's also what makes it hard to watch, but I think that's not something that you think about or realize when you're watching it.
No, I think that's one of those, it's been a week, I'm still thinking about this. Mm-hmm. Oh, fuck.
Yeah.
I'm complicit in part of this, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Alex West has a piece about that as well. So she talks about how he sets this potentially nihilistic film against the clean stainless steel backdrop of the upper middle class bourgeois family, who also happen to be part of a network that destroys young women as a perverted means of affirming the existence of an afterlife. The antagonists are clean, well-dressed, educated elite who brutally torture innocent subjects with the same clinical organization they utilize to maintain their immaculate homes.
And they're all white. I don't think there's a single person of color
they
in
are
this cult.
All fucking white. And, like, I don't think... Okay, people sometimes accuse us of reaching.
Yeah, yeah.
Guess what? It was not a mistake to cast two, like,
women of color.
Two women of color, two other minority figures in this film against a sea of white, rich people. Rich, yeah. White people.
It's totally intentional.
It is totally intentional.
And, okay, that really makes me want to go into the queer stuff then, because that's another thing. So that makes Anna other.
Mm-hmm.
So I found this quote, and it made me think about how to read Anna's queerness into the end of the film in a positive light, and maybe this can be a discussion. So This is Andrew Cousins in The Philosophy of Martyrs, Transcendence and Torture, and he writes, "Lucy is the cause Anna has that allows her to accept the suffering she is put under. While the others had antagonistic visions, Anna's is of someone she loves and accepts. One would assume that a pious religious martyr would have visions of their deity. By accepting rather than fighting the vision, the victim becomes a martyr." So I took that, just thinking about, I was like, yeah, because, like, when you think of a martyr, you think, oh, someone who dies for their religious beliefs.
Yeah.
And I've said this before, I grew up very Catholic. My mother, like, went to Catholic school where the nuns beat you with rulers in Backwoods, Louisiana. And, like, I was I went through confirmation. I did all this shit. Like, I mean, I am familiar with Catholicism, you could say. Mm-hmm. So I thought about this. And I was like, okay, the deity. I think she doesn't have a vision of her deity because, as all of us know, most religions view homosexuality or queerness as a sin. It is mm-hmm. a mortal sin. You're going to hell, blah, 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 blah. But she's the one to experience this, to witness the afterlife. And of course, we don't know what she sees. But I think that she doesn't have a vision of her deity because she believes that her deity has rejected her. She's gay or queer in some way. You know, we don't label her.
Yeah.
That's why she doesn't see a deity. At least I don't think she does. And it's her love for a woman, for her friend, that she is held onto that allows her to become a martyr. So in a sense, it is her queerness that allows her this privilege, if you will, to sneak a peek into the afterlife while still being alive.
Oh, that's so sweet.
I again, I th- I have not seen this reading anywhere, so if anyone else has had it, I apologize, but I'm co-opting it. Because I think that's a positive way to look at this, in the sense that, you know, her queerness is what allows her to do this. And maybe that, you could view that as bad, because it's like, well, that sucks, though. Because then it, like, justifies all the torture she went through, but I don't think that's what it's, that's not how I read it. I mean, I guess it justifies it for the cult, but it's just something that allows her an extra level of existence, of insight, that her straight counterparts who get horrible visions and don't have kindness, like, that's an interesting way of looking at it. It's like, hey, like, the people that aren't queer, they get fucked up the most. Whereas queerness, maybe even growing up queer and suffering enough, like, your whole life, that's why she has happiness when she's going through the worst things in her life. Like,
yeah, she's been suffering the whole fucking time.
Mm-hmm. But she's also been suffering internally her whole life.
Yeah. I really like that, because I've seen a couple of other people talk about how Anna's love for Lucy is the thing that ends up getting her into this position. And even OJ himself says, you know, oh, it's, you know, it's this love for the wrong person that gets you into trouble, and how if she hadn't loved Lucy, then she wouldn't have fallen into the situation. I just thought, that is so fucking dark, because it not only suggests had she not loved Lucy, she would have been safe, but also, like, there's a certain condemnation then of queerness, right?
Well, that's going back to our Hostel 2 episode where I brought up BJ Colangelo's criticism of that film, where it's like, well, none of that movie would have happened if Beth wasn't queer and fallen for the honeypot XL.
Exactly.
And I
get
it.
Which, again, if you look at this film as conversation with Hostel Part 2 and Part 1, like, hello, rich, meaningful dialogue that we're having.
Yeah. No, I understand that reading. I don't subscribe to it. I don't believe that, because, again, if it was a straight person, it'd be the same fucking thing.
Well, and I think even if you do believe that idea, like, okay, whatever. I mean, guess what? If Anna wasn't there, we wouldn't have a movie. But also, okay, fine. Fine. I'll go along with this idea. You know what? Shit. It would have been so much better for her if she hadn't have fallen into this trap. But then if we subscribe to your reading, it gives it this happier alternative where she does find peace. She does find happiness and satisfaction. And it's only because of her love for Lucy that she manages to achieve that state at the end of this film.
Exactly.
And that's beautiful.
And, yeah. And it's, I mean, like, again, it doesn't make me happier about her fate, but but it gives me a sense of peace, though, knowing that she's at peace, or at least believing, because you can also watch this and not believe that she's at peace, because, again, we don't know what she says to Mademoiselle, whether it's truth or lie, or whether it's good or bad.
Oh, yeah, like, Anna is effectively mute as of the entire last act of this film. We never hear her speak again.
I like to believe that she's trolling Mademoiselle and just tells her something that she knows is gonna, like, make her want to kill herself.
Okay, well, maybe that's a good transition into what the fuck is the meaning of the end of this film? What do people think?
Okay, so I got another quote, and I actually really like this one because it puts the movie in a new context for me that goes with spoiler culture for today. Okay, so this is from thisberry.com. Oh, this is, love it. Martyrs, movie plot ending explained is the name of the article.
Oh, my favorite.
I know. I had no hopes reading this, but here's the thing. All right, so they mentioned, like, imagine, like, The Sixth Sense comes out, someone tells you the ending. Well, do you want to go see it now? No, you're like, well, I already know the ending. What am I going to do? Imagine you're going to Vegas and someone tells you, hey, you actually are not going to win anything today. Okay, cool. You're not going to want to go to the casino. So, this person who is not credited writes, life, in a sense, comes with a twist at the end. Death. Many cultures believe that the purpose of life is revealed in the afterlife. But what if it is the suspense presented by life that gives us all a purpose to live each day? If the suspense was removed, then suddenly there would no longer be the urge to live. We will never know what Anna's whispers were, but whatever it was, it leaves Mademoiselle with a knowledge that removes her purpose to live. She doesn't want to give out the information to the society, as that will only lead to more suicides. I don't even know if I buy into that, but whatever. The knowledge she has is overbearing and will most likely remove the will to live for everyone in the society, so she takes her life without disclosing the secret to life, universe, and everything. All she says is to keep doubting. Perhaps it's the doubt of the afterlife that keeps humans from killing themselves right away and cut to the chase. It's the doubt that gives our life purpose. Now, what I view this as, it's the ultimate spoiler warning. Like, what she's basically, like, spoils death for Mademoiselle, and that just removes her will to live. And it just because you know how people are so touchy with spoilers nowadays, because with social media, people will go and tweet the ending of Game of Thrones as soon as it ends, saying, "Oh, I can't believe this happened," and people get so fucking up in arms about it, and they're so pissy. Mm-hmm. And so this movie is kind of a microcosm of that entire spoiler culture to me.
Oh my god. Well, interestingly enough, that also subscribes back to the way that you read why, in part, Lucy kills herself, right? She's accomplished her goal. She maybe doesn't see something else to live for. And you could say maybe Mademoiselle feels the same, right? But I've seen people also speculate that it's she got notice of something that leads her to believe, okay, I want to go there right now. So that's why she says, I'm not even going to wait. I'm just going to kill myself so I can get to that.
Okay, but see, though, she does wait because she does have a conversation with Etienne before she kills herself. So why doesn't she tell them too, you know?
She always seemed like a bit of a selfish biddy to me.
She's a selfish bitch. No, what was your... be it from this rewatch or from your first viewing of the film, what did you make of it? What do you think? And I don't know if it really is worth trying to guess what Anna told her.
I have no interest in
I don't either. Any answer we get is not going to be satisfactory.
It's not
going to
satisfy. It's so much more interesting when we have to think about it for ourselves, and then we can have these debates, right? It's just another example of how the film wants you to keep talking about it and keep processing it.
Yes, and it's not easy. It's not an easy conversation. And I think also what you take, whatever your view is of what she says, or what you take away from the ending, will also go into not only your religious beliefs, but just who you are as a person. Your personality and who you are feeds into what you make of this ending. And that also might be why some discussions are hard, because, I'm not a person to discuss religion or politics with people, especially new people that I've met, because it's just or on social media, because it's
a fool's errand. It's gonna go badly.
But those beliefs, political and religious ones, are gonna feed your what you think of this ending and what you think is happening here. And I think that will also is what makes conversations hard, because by talking about this movie with someone, you are indirectly giving away what your opinions are in politics and religion without actually having those conversations.
Yeah. I mean, as someone who's not religious, to me, the word choice, the doubt, was always the most fascinating thing. It's not keep guessing. She's not suggesting, haha, I know something and you don't.
Right.
She's not saying keep striving, it's keep doubting. Doubting of what, right? So I love that ambiguity and the oddness of that word choice. It's such a deliciously unusual choice for
me. Keep doubting?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I remember watching this the first time and just thinking, what the fuck is this? Because really, this film does not ever go where I think it's going to go.
No, it does not.
It changes structures 3 different times. By the time you get to the torture, you think, okay, I guess we're just going to watch this girl get murdered. That's not satisfying.
It is roughly a 15-minute torture sequence, so it is lengthy. Of course, it's nothing compared to what the actual timeline is.
But it is roughly double what we watched with Heather Matarazzo, which is the longest torture sequence in Hostel.
Yeah, exactly.
Hostels. Yeah. Hostels. But really, at the end of the day, I love that this film ends on an extremely nihilistic ending. All of the characters that we have watched, that we have grown to love and empathize, they're dead.
Mm-hmm.
Or, if Anna's not dead, because I feel like she's still alive at the end of the film, but I desperately want her to die, because that just seems like such a terrible state.
Well, yeah, the last thing we have of Anna is she's fucking essentially crucified, skinless, and martyring out.
Yeah, and just hanging out in the basement while all these rich white fuckers hang out and party upstairs.
Oh, yeah, they're literally, are they holding champagne flutes? I think they are.
I think so, yeah. Oh my god.
So fucked up.
And if you can't read that rich elitism reading into this, then I can't even help you.
Oh, yeah, no. What's an expensive champagne? Cristal. They're drinking Cristal.
But yeah, the fact that Mademoiselle just kills herself, and that's the end of the film.
That's it.
I love it. I can't think of a better way to end a movie like this.
No, and it's... this might be a good transition into the remake to have a small discussion about that before we close out. But no, I mean, like, I imagine, like, you're this movie, the credits roll in this movie, and you are just sitting there, like, probably throughout the rest of the credits.
Stunned.
Taking this in.
Yeah. Yeah.
But.
Okay. So, and then we get to revisit the whole shebang for 2015's Martyrs. The remake.
Which is a Blumhouse production.
Oh, my God.
I had no idea.
I could not. When that came up, I just immediately went, wow, Weinstein's and Blumhouse again and again and again and again.
And what's funny is, though, while Martyrs, the original, doesn't have the traits you would normally see from a Weinstein film, the remake does have the traits you would see from a Blumhouse film. It is directed by the Goetz brothers. I don't know who they are. We didn't do a lot of research on this. Like, wait, no. What?
Oh, I just said question mark. Like, who the fuck are these guys?
I don't know. Listeners, we didn't do a lot of research on this because we actually weren't planning on watching the remake. We just both happened to watch it without telling the other one. So, again, this is going
to
be a brief...
I was so curious. I just had to know.
Well, and here's the thing. It is not as bad as you think it's going to be. And I don't think it's bad. It just doesn't have the impact. There's less violence and torture in it, which some would say defeats the purpose.
Mm-hmm.
And listeners, the big change that the remake makes is Lucy, played by Troy and Belisario, does not kill herself in this version. And rather than finding a woman downstairs who has a metal visor and codpiece, they find a little girl who is not tortured. She's just there.
No.
And it is about 15 minutes shorter than the original, and it really plays a factor in the first half. A lot of moments, Lucy still asks the boy, like, how old are you? Do you know what your parents did? But it rushes through it. You don't really get that moment of, like, hesitation that you get in the original. So you lose a lot of beats that make the original so effective that this one just kind of skates by.
Yeah, I think the thing that bothered me right off the bat was when Lucy kills both of the kids, you don't see the violence. So you hear her shoot the boy, and you do see his body briefly later on when he gets dumped into the pit. Mm-hmm. And she shoots the little girl under the bed, and you just see this puff of down comforter go up in the air. Mm-hmm. And then you see the girl's body in the pit later, and she literally does not have a scratch on her. Like, this is an American movie that is afraid to kill kids.
I will say that I don't prefer the girl's death in the remake, but I do like it because the way that this shot is done is, yes, she shoots her under the bed and she does hit her, whereas in the original she doesn't hit her, the girl crawls out, she gets killed, she gets shot, but the camera is panning overhead over the bed, and you just, like, it holds it. This is one of the few times that they hold something in this film. And you're waiting, and you just see the blood trickle out from the foot of the bed and just, like, flood out. And so I thought that was actually, if there's anything positive to say about the remake, it's that it's a very well shot film.
Yes.
It looks great, like you would expect a Blumhouse production to be. The weird thing with this movie is, though, like, it was being made. There was no marketing, no publicity. No. It didn't go to theaters. Like, it was dumped. I owned the Blu-ray only because we got a review copy of it. Like, I don't know what was going on with this movie and why it didn't even get, not even a theatrical release, which whatever, but, like, not even, like, a push for VOD and streaming. It's so bizarre to me.
I feel like they knew it was a lost cause. I don't know if they didn't have faith in the final film or if they just realized, oh, shit, we made a bad decision. This original is too well-beloved, and we have not done a good enough job adapting it. Because this... I mean, I say, I know I do this a lot, but this remake feels defanged. They took all of the things that work the best about the original, not just the gore, but the relationship, like the time, the relationship between the two girls, and the process. Like, the torture in this 2015 remake is non-existent. We see an extended take of Lucy getting her back flayed. And then they don't show it ever again.
Yeah.
They just show her in her regular clothes, strung up in front of everyone.
She doesn't get fully flayed. It's just the back. And again, that sounds silly. It's just her back skin getting pulled
off. Just her back. Come on.
But here's the thing, because I don't hate... we discussed this off mic, but the Martyrs remake is a better movie than the Inside remake. Or at least it has more of a purpose.
Oh,
because,
my God, yes.
Because this movie, while it is defanged, it has a different focus. The focus of the remake isn't on the philosophy. It's more about the friendship. Now, it removes the queerness between the girls completely. There's no attempted kiss.
Of course it does.
Of course it does. Blumhouse. Yay. Or 2015 Blumhouse. You know, Happy Death Day comes out 2 years later. It focuses on them as friends, and that is the focus. It's not about the organization, even though it does come into play. And Mademoiselle is played by Kate Burton, who listeners may know as Dr. Ellis Gray from Grey's Anatomy, or Vice President Sally Langston from Scandal. That's what I know her from. And she's a huge cunt. But it's weird. So we didn't discuss this in the original, but what gets Anna caught is that when she calls her mother, she leaves the phone off the hook. And the organization is trying to call and they can't get through. So that's what brings them to the house to begin with. What the remake does is Anna calls the cops, and we are led to believe that the organization has even more power because the cops are under their thumbs.
It's motherfucking Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Yes, it's very much like that. And so there's a scene later when Mademoiselle, I don't even know what her name, her name is Eleanor, I think, in the remake. She is explaining to Anna everything that they're doing, just like in the original.
But, like, not half as well.
Not half as well. And says, oh, yeah, you actually brought us here because you called the cops. Why this doesn't work for me, though, and why this exposition dump doesn't work for me compared to the original is because Lucy is alive. They are still using Lucy as their end goal of martyrdom.
Yeah, she is their preferred choice. Anna is like, oh, who fucking cares that you're even here? And
yes.
Then they, what do they do?
They dump her in the ground and bury her alive in the hole in the back, which that's fine. But then why are you giving her this exposition dump if you don't give a shit about her? If you're just going to bury her, why even take the time?
Oh, wait, is it for the audience? Because you don't trust us?
Yep. And it's so weird. It's a really odd choice. And I think it's just because when it came out, Pretty Little Liars was still like in peak popularity. Maybe not as much as it was in like 2012, let's say.
But still quite popular.
But yeah, no, I went into this thinking, oh, they're going to kill their biggest star in the film halfway through, and they don't. But what makes the film kind of work for me, and again, this is like a 2.5. I did review this for Bloody when it came out, and I gave it a 3 in the Bloody Disgusting review. And it's impossible to watch this film without comparing it to the original. But the ending scene, basically, they have Lucy crucified and they burn her at the stake, but then she's never like, she doesn't have any burn marks on her. It's really weird. But she basically, Anna gets a gun and runs through and kills a bunch of people, and then she goes there and she gets like Lucy off the cross, and Lucy is experiencing martyrdom and whispers to Anna what she has seen.
Mm-hmm.
The priest overhears it and blows his brains out.
which doesn't work.
No, it doesn't work at all. But then Eleanor K. Burton's like, what did she see? And Lucy and Anna goes, you tell me, and then blows her brains out, kills her, which that's, again, the easy catharsis that they're trying to give American audiences. And that is treating us like we're stupid. I hate that.
Well, the whole thing is that if you're not going to kill Lucy and turn Anna into your martyr, then you don't need Anna. So Anna just becomes the really conventional final girl.
Yes.
Where, you know, she's grabbing weapons. She's surviving getting stabbed. She, you know, she survives getting buried alive. Her whole purpose is literally just to get back to her. And then you bury the lead. She does all this like stupid killing. And then she still dies from her pain, but she has also achieved martyrdom.
Yes.
Oh, so, my God. It feels like a slap in the face.
I don't mind her also achieving. I mean, it doesn't make any sense. But I also don't think the film does a great job enough of, like, explaining this concept of martyrdom as the original does.
No. It's nice because the friendship survives. Like, they both gone to this new place together.
The film ends with both of them, like Anna is, like, draped herself over Lucy, and they are both, martyring out, looking at the sky as they slowly die. And that's, like, the film blacks out. I know. It's a little schlocky, but the reason I give this remake at least a little bit of credit is because it at least does something different with the property. Not wholly successfully, but it does something. And it's not one I'm ever going to want to watch again, because I've already seen it twice. But I think if you didn't have the original, it would maybe play a little bit better, but it's still not great.
Yeah, to be honest, I just think it's too out there a concept to have successfully adapted for a North American audience. Mm-hmm. So you either needed to really just adapt it exactly the way it was and just make all the actors American, or I don't know. Like, I just think the philosophy is too integral to what this film is trying to do. So to do it only halfway as the American remake does, mm-hmm. it feels so watered down.
I mean, yeah, absolutely. And it's by design. And that feels like I don't know if that was the producers or if that was the directors or mm-hmm. even just the writer. I don't know. But again, I think it's a very pretty film. I think it's shot very well.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't look bad. The girls are trying. They just don't really have a lot to work with.
I think it's an editing issue, to be honest. I think like a lot of the reason, I do think their performances are good, but I think the editing kills a lot of the momentum for me.
Well, it's also not scary.
No, it's not scary at all. But yeah, so that's The Martyrs remake. Check it out if you want to, I guess, but... Or just watch the original.
Just watch the original.
So yeah, I mean, that's going to wrap up that discussion. Obviously, you know, there's a lot of things to talk about in this film. Please let us know. Message us, whatever. Talk about shit. On that note, though, if you'd like to contact us, you can visit our Horror Queers Facebook page or join our Horror Queers Facebook group. Tweet us at Horror Queers or email us at horrorqueers@gmail.com. We would love it if you would go to iTunes and leave us a review, or if you don't have the time for a review, leave us just a star rating. That works too. If you want even more content, please visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/horrorqueers, where you can sign up for bonus episodes covering recent horror films like Gretel and Hansel and Blumhouse's Fantasy Island. And $10 patrons will also have an audio commentary on Valentine, which we dropped last week just in time for Valentine's Day. Predictable, but appropriate. Joe.
Mm-hmm.
What are we talking about next week for my birthday?
Well, you know, I was tempted to just kick it back to you because it's your birthday, but yeah, you have decided that your birthday pick, we are going to watch Zombievers? Why have we both chosen such random picks for our birthday?
I don't know if we will have a lot. This might be a 45-minute episode for all I know. I have no idea. The movie, I think, is about 72 minutes long, and that is including the animated opening credit sequence.
God. What am I in for here?
I genuinely love this movie. I think it's so funny. But again, y'all, it's not a queer content movie, although there is a Lady Gaga joke that's really funny. And there's no substance to it, so... We may just be drinking wine and having fun with it, so it might not be a regular episode next week, but that's what I wanted for my birthday, because it drops the day before my birthday, so.
There we go.
Yeah, but that'll be next week, and on that note, we can cross out Martyrs's.
Yes, I'm going to go Martyrs out for a little while, so cross out Horror Queers.
Disgusting podcast network, home of creepy, disturbing, and terrifying creepypastas. SCP archives, weekly full cast storytelling, horror queers, genre commentary from an LGBTQ perspective, and the Boo Crew for horror-centric interviews. Listen free wherever you stream audio, and at bloodydisgusting.com/podcasts.
Murder in America is a true crime podcast that covers stories from all 50 states, including stories of mass shootings, serial killers, and lesser-known murders. Do you find yourself doing more research after listening to a true crime show? Well, Courtney and I used to do the same thing, and that's why we created Murder in America. Our podcast dives deep into each case. Our storytelling will make you feel like you're right there within the case with us, watching it all play out, and we do not shy away from the graphic details. If you're a fan of true crime, then listen to Murder in America on Spotify now.
Every town has its dark history. Hometown Ghost Stories is a paranormal podcast that goes town to town all across the globe, exploring the world's most haunted places, tapping into the dusty archives and the darkest corners to bring you the most terrifying stories of real people and their harrowing experiences. Hometown Ghost Stories dives into the history of haunted locations and investigates why and how these places earned their terrifying reputation. Rob, Dave, and Jesse go live every Tuesday night after an uninterrupted documentary-style breakdown on the case, followed by an open discussion with live viewers. Subscribe today to listen to Hometown Ghost Stories on your preferred podcast platform or watch the video version on YouTube and now Spotify. Head on over to the Bloody FM Podcast Network and check out Hometown Ghost Stories, if you're brave enough.